We'd want to rethink your share if you came in on this. 20% might be more reasonable. Dr. Papineau grunted a low, I never have gotten around to selling that lot on Lake Namekagon. It's just sitting there, he said. How many does he want to start with? 12 for now. A pilot run at Christmas and then something bigger next year. I suppose I could talk to Trudy next time I'm out. They were quiet for a time. You know, Stumpy's having a fish boil on Saturday. First of the summer. Is that right? Lake trout? They turned and walked up the kennel aisle. Whitefish, I think. Why don't we swing by and pick you up? I could make myself scarce if you wanted to talk to Trudy then. Edgar watched them go. After Dr. Papineau had driven away, he walked into the house and clapped his leg to call Almondine to go upstairs, all the while feeling Claude's gaze on his back. When Saturday night came, Edgar made it clear he wasn't going anywhere with Claude. His mother feigned indifference, as with a contrary pup, though he knew she felt otherwise. The moment the Impala's taillights disappeared, he rifled the mail drawer, then the kennel files laid on top of the freezer, and the working notebooks. Almondine sat and watched him search. In the closet, he checked the pockets of Claude's coat and trousers. He found nothing to help make sense of that overheard conversation. Then he turned to more unlikely places. The ammo box with the old telegram. The truck. And finally, the spare room. It was almost empty and had been since Claude moved out. But on the interior wall was a small door. He crouched and opened it and looked into the unfinished rafter space above the kitchen. There, stacked haphazardly across the dusty bats of pink insulation, were a dozen cardboard boxes, the ones his mother had packed that winter day he'd come upon her with her hair wild about her head and so lost in grief she hadn't even seen him. He knelt on the joists and pulled the boxes into the room. They were printed with logos for canned tomatoes, baked beans, ketchup, their flaps crossed and taped down. The heaviest were jammed with shirts and trousers, exuding the faint scent of his father's aftershave. Edgar ran his hands along the insides, feeling for anything not fabric. Two of the boxes held coats and hats, and two more shoes. Finally, a smaller box of miscellany. His father's spring-banded wristwatch, his razor, his key ring, his empty leather billfold, shiny on the flanks but the corners stretched and pale and the stitching unraveling on one side. From the bottom, Edgar lifted out a Mellon High School yearbook, class of 1948. Tucked inside the front cover was his father's diploma, printed on thick stock with Mellon High School crested across the top. He paged through the black-and-white photographs until he found his father among the 25 graduates between Donald Rogers and Marjorie Schneider. His father's expression was severe, in the style of many of the portraits, and his gaze focused on some distant concern. He'd worn glasses even then. Edgar turned to the sophomores. Claude was listed as one of three without a picture. Edgar scrutinized the posed group shots and candids, the football team, the farm club, the choral group, the crowd in the cafeteria. In the process, two loose photographs slipped from the latter pages. People and places he didn't recognize. He shook the yearbook over his lap. Three more photographs fluttered out. In one, his father stood on a lakeshore fishing. In the other, he sat in a truck, sporting several days' growth of beard. His elbow rested on the open window, and his hand was draped over the steering wheel. The final photograph had been taken in their yard. In it, the barn appeared in the distance, rising darkly above the slope of the side lawn. His father was looking on from near the milk house, a tiny figure. In the foreground stood Claude, dressed in a T-shirt and jeans. A massive, full-grown dog had just leapt into his outstretched arms. He was laughing and staggering backward, and one of his eyes was black. Edgar sat looking at the photograph. The dog, in motion when the shutter was tripped, appeared mostly as a blur, but it was very big, that much was obvious. It didn't look like one of their dogs, not exactly. A mix of some kind, though predominantly shepherd, with a dark face, high-set ears, and a saber tail. Edgar turned the photograph over. On the back, in his father's draftsman-like handwriting, a caption read, "Claude and Forte, July 1948. Claude had taken on the kennel paperwork, an idea Edgar's mother welcomed. Edgar found Claude at the kitchen table often, letters spread about, talking on the telephone for follow-ups and new placements. If Edgar walked in during one of his conversations, Claude would cut his conversation short, as if his brother's work was hard enough without his being under observation as well. The files and records themselves were neatly organized and legible. The problem was mastering the lineage of the dogs available for breeding the next litter, and holding all the requisite information in his head. Claude knew the basics, of course. John Sautel had drilled the principles of animal husbandry into both his sons. But Claude had been away from the kennel long enough that the complex scoring system, refined by Edgar's father over the years, was now a mystery to him. On the other hand, Claude's attitude toward any accomplishment was cool indifference, a studious lack of awe. No matter what the feat, whether a pyrotechnic piano solo on a variety show, or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar sinking a last-minute skyhook for the Bucks, Claude was unimpressed. He often declared that a person could get anything he wanted if he was willing to go slow enough. The pianist, he would point out, had sacrificed his childhood practicing. Of course he could tickle the ivories. Jabbar was born tall, and he worked at the game 5 days a week all year round. "Everyone gets good at their job," he said. "It's osmosis, the most ordinary thing in the world." Edgar's mother laughed when Claude started in, having decided it was a form of backhanded compliment, since the more impressive the feat, the more steadfastly Claude held to his position. It wasn't disrespectful, he maintained, because the principle applied to everyone straight across the board, Trudy, Edgar, and most especially Claude himself. It was never a question of whether Claude could learn to do something, just a question of whether it would be worthwhile and how long it would take. This was his approach to mastering the kennel records, and learning to read sign, for that matter, despite the fact that he walked past the sign dictionary in the living room every day. If he kept his hands in the files long enough, the scoring system would become clear, and the merits and flaws of the various lines would sink in without effort. During telephone conversations, he idly flipped through whatever folder happened to be in front of him, doodling lineage charts on the newspaper. His father had been planning a litter for a sweet-natured black-and-chestnut mother named Olive. He had spoken of finding a perfect cross, but Claude had searched fruitlessly in Edgar's father's notebook. As Edgar well knew, that notebook was a mess of illegible notes, lists, reminders, and diagrams. The same man who filled out log records with the precision of a penmanship teacher wrote his notes in a madman's scribble. But Olive was coming into heat soon, and Claude sat at the table after dinner behind an avalanche of manila folders. Late one evening, he walked into the living room. "I have Gar's cross for Olive," he said. Edgar's mother looked up from the magazine she'd been reading. "Who?" "Drift," he said. "He's sired 3 good litters, healthy as a horse. He's down in Park City." Edgar's mother nodded. She had intuition on crosses based on her memory of how past litters behaved, but she had always been indifferent to the detailed research, leaving that to Edgar's father. The pups were what excited her, all their talents as yet unrevealed. But Edgar saw the problem at once, and he was signing a response before he had time for second thoughts. "That's a line cross, a bad one." Trudy looked back at Claude and interpreted. "A line cross?"
"Let's see," Claude said. "Olive was sired by..."
He retreated into the kitchen and rummaged through papers.
"I'll be damned," they heard him say. "Olive and Drift are both from the same sire, one generation apart. Half Nelson, sired by Nelson, who was out of Bridger and Azimuth."
"What's the problem with that?" his mother asked. "Remember Half Nelson and Osmo?" Edgar signed. "Oh, yes," she said. "Not good."
Claude had returned, but he couldn't read Edgar's sign.
"Meaning?"
"Meaning that a couple of years ago, Half Nelson sired a litter out of Osmo, with three pups stillborn, and the rest with straight fronts. Gar decided it was a bad cross."
He had decided more than that, Edgar thought. His father had considered that litter a disaster. He'd paid scant attention to superficial traits like coat color, but bones mattered, and straight fronts, which meant bad angulation and the dog's forelegs, were hard to eliminate from a line. And yet Osmo had borne good litters from other sires. Edgar's father had spent most of the day pulling folders and making notes, until he'd tapped his pencil twice and announced that he'd found what he was looking for. Line crosses with a common ancestor in Nelson. Edgar sat with him while he talked it through, and he could still see the diagrams they'd drawn.
"Would have been nice to know that a couple of days ago," Claude said.
"Edgar didn't know you were considering Drift until just now," his mother said, before Edgar could respond. She turned to him. "Who would be good, then? Do you have an opinion?"
Edgar wanted to leave Claude hanging, make him work it out for himself so he would look foolish and slow. Any help he gave Claude would only advance his brainless theory of osmosis. But Edgar wasn't sure Claude wouldn't take a wild guess, and he couldn't stand the idea of the dogs being used clumsily.
"Gleam," he signed, "or one of his sibs." After Trudy translated, Claude pursed his lips and returned to the kitchen while Edgar grinned. His mother gave him a "don't push it, Buster" squint and turned back to her magazine. He knew what Claude would find. Gleam was a 4-year-old brindle placed with a farm family east of town. The little boy who lived there sometimes sought out Edgar at school to tell him about the dog. He also knew Claude wouldn't find any problem with the cross. He'd have to go back 7 generations before he found any common ancestry, if he bothered to look that far. When Edgar came downstairs the next morning, Claude was sitting at the table, manila folders stacked before him.
"We're going with Gleam," he said. He waved a coffee cup over the records. "Did you want to check me on this? I'm going to call the owner this afternoon and arrange it."
Edgar tried to think of a response, but his mind seized up. He shrugged and walked to the doorway.
"Look," Claude said, "is there something in particular you want to say? It's just me and you here. Whatever's on your mind will stay between us."
Edgar stopped. "I bet it will," he signed. He thought how he'd capitulated the night before, how he'd helped Claude, though it was the last thing in the world he'd wanted to do. Slowly, and with great precision, so that the gesture was unmistakable, Edgar angled his left hand in front of him and shot his right beneath it, index finger as straight as the knife it was meant to evoke.
"Murder. That's what's on my mind."
Claude's eyes tracked Edgar's hands. He looked as if he were searching his memory, nodding all the while noncommittally. Edgar turned and walked onto the porch.
"I just want you to know," Claude called from the kitchen, "picking Gleam like that. I was impressed."
Edgar pushed through the screen door and let it slam, blood rising in his cheeks.
He'd mustered the resolve to accuse Claude to his face, yet somehow Claude had twisted the moment into a chance to look magnanimous. And to whom? No one had been there to see it. Worst of all, Claude's compliment had elicited in him a flush of pride that made him instantly loathe himself. The problem, the very troubling problem, was that when he wanted to, Claude could sound so much like Edgar's father. Night. He stood in the bathroom and crossed his arms at his waist and peeled his shirt over his head and looked in the mirror. Where a story had once been written in mottled blue and green, now only pale and ordinary flesh. Memory of his father's hands sinking into that spot. How, with the slightest pressure, his heart might have stopped. The stream of memory passing through him like rain, now as faint and undetailed as dreams called back from sleep. He pressed a thumb to his sternum. A familiar ache lit his ribs. He swung his arm wide, hand curled into a fist. The sensation, when he brought it to his chest, exquisite. Warm afternoons, he walked with Almandine into the woods, where they slept under the dying oak. Sometimes he took Essay or Tinder along to make it look like training. Whenever his mother insisted he spend the night in the house, he waited until she and Claude were asleep, then led Almandine downstairs, bearing all his weight onto the creaking treads. From the bedroom doorway, his mother watched him rummage through the refrigerator.
"What are you doing?"
"Going to the barn."
"It's 11 o'clock at night."
"So?"
"Oh, for God's sake, if you can't sleep, read something."
He slammed the back door and stalked across the yard. Yet he couldn't oppose them in everything. One problem that irked him especially was naming the newest litter, something he'd delayed for 3 weeks. But now the pup's eyes were open, and their milk teeth were beginning to come through, and they had begun exploring. The earliest puppy training would start soon, the playing of unusual sounds, the setting up of miniature stairs and hoops, and all those puzzles for infants. And when that began, they had to have names. He carried the dark blue New Webster Encyclopedic Dictionary of the English language into the whelping pen and sank cross-legged into the straw. Four pups bumbled to the edge of the whelping box and looked at him. The spine of the dictionary cracked dryly when he laid it open. He splayed the pages through his fingers. Annotations flickered past, the oldest in his father's handwriting, but most in his own squarish lettering. Good names had once lived between the dictionary's covers. Butter, Surrey, Pan, Cable, Argo. Sometimes he could even remember the exact place he'd been sitting when the word had risen from the page and declared itself to be a name. At the back of the dictionary was an essay by Alexander McQueen, the editor, entitled 2,000 Names and Their Meanings, a practical guide for parents and all others interested in better naming. Edgar knew it by heart. "The naming of an infant is of more than passing importance," McQueen had written. He listed 7 rules for choosing names, such as, "The name should be worthy, it should be easy to pronounce, and it should be original." Now, the more Edgar thought about those rules, the more the unclaimed words turned to nonsense. Spire, encore, pretend, herb. The mother dog lifted her nose to scent the dry pages, then sighed to acknowledge his difficulties, and he closed the dictionary. The pups had fallen asleep, except one who fussed at a nipple, nursing, then letting go, then taking it again. He reached past the pup and rolled the nipple between his fingers and brought his fingers wet to his nose and tongue. "What are you complaining about?" he signed. He set aside the dictionary and shifted the pup back into place, stroking it two-fingered while it nursed, and he didn't stop until it, too, lay asleep. Afterward, he herded his litter into the workshop and up the narrow steps, stopping only to retrieve the photograph of Claude and Forte from its hiding place, tucked into the envelope with the Hachiko letter. The Mao was still warm from the day's heat. He swung open the broad door at the front and let the night air wash in, cool and thick with pollen. The dogs wrestled and plunged across the straw bales at the back, for the once vast wall of yellow had diminished to a low platform. They would need more straw soon. That meant a day standing at the Mao door, waiting at a creaking conveyor for bales and driving in the hay hook and stacking them, cross-hatched, to the rafters. He looked out at the dark woods. He wondered if Schultz had imagined teams of men working where he stood at harvest time, shouting, cursing, taunting those below to bring on the hay as they hauled on the sling ropes. When the dogs settled down, he shut the door and they began to work. He'd forsaken the regular training schedule, instead teaching them playful acts with no point and no purpose. Tagging one another, carrying scraps of doweling from place to place, dropping to the floor during a carry. Watching the dogs was the only thing that put him at ease, and he made a game of it, trying variations, setting up barriers, switching the order, testing connotations. A tag, they decided, meant not merely scenting another dog, but a solid nose push. A carry meant not dropping a thing, even when a tennis ball rolled by. Edgar found a pen and an old spoon and a length of welding rod, and he asked the dogs to take those items in their mouths instead of doweling, despite their strange texture and taste. When they'd agreed on this new meaning of carry, an hour had passed, and he declared a break. While the dogs lounged in the loose straw, Edgar took out the photograph of Claude and Forte. The stray was on his mind for the first time in a long while. Such a foolish dream to have hoped the dog would come in from the woods. He thought of that day in the field, how swiftly Claude had turned to shoot the doe after the stray bolted. After a while, he slid the photograph back into his pocket, and he read from the Jungle Book, letting his hands swipe through the air. So loud did he howl that Tha heard him and said, "What is the sorrow?" And the first of the tigers, lifting up his muzzle to the new-made sky, which is now so old, said, "Give me back my power, O Tha. I am made ashamed before all the jungle, and I have run away from an hairless one, and he has called me a shameful name." "And why?" said Tha. "Because I am smeared with the mud of the marshes," said the first of the tigers. "Swim, then, and roll on the wet grass, and if it be mud it will surely wash away," said Tha. And the first of the tigers swam and rolled, till the jungle ran round and round before his eyes. But not one little bar upon his hide was changed, and Tha, watching him, laughed. Then the first of the tigers said, "What have I done that this comes to me?" Tha said, "Thou hast killed the buck, and thou hast let death loose in the jungle, and with death has come fear, so that the people of the jungle are afraid one of the other, as thou art afraid of the hairless one." The first of the tigers said, "They will never fear me, for I knew them since the beginning." Tha said, "Go and see." And the first of the tigers ran to and fro, calling aloud to the deer, and the pig, and the somber, and the porcupine, and all the jungle peoples. But they all ran away from him, who had been their judge, because they were afraid. He roused the dogs again, and began rehearsing two new commands. He began with "away," demonstrating in small increments. At first, it was enough to look somewhere else without moving. The shared gaze training helped now, and they caught on quickly. Then he coaxed them into taking a step, then several steps, then running all the way across the Mao. Finch was the first to get it. No place in particular to go, just not here. The dog fairly danced with excitement. Far more difficult was the idea that another dog might convey a command. For example, if he wanted Babu to down, all Edgar had to do was lift his hand in the air. Sawtelle pups knew that sign when they were 3 months old. But now he wanted Babu to down if Finch or Essay nosed him on the hip. They called this linking, teaching a dog that one action automatically followed another. Linking was what made a dog sit when his companion stopped walking. Linking was what made for a clean finish on a recall, when the dog not only returned, but circled behind and sat on one's left. And when it came to linking, the Sawtelle dogs were genuinely gifted. He put Babu in a stay and stepped one pace back. "Tag," he signed to Essay, indicating Babu. The instant Essay touched the dog, Edgar raised his hand. Babu downed. A moment of revelry. They practiced again, this time with Babu tagging. After dozens of trials, with breaks to race for a knotted rag thrown into the dark corners of the mow, they'd all gotten the hang of it. He moved them farther apart, 5, 10, 20 feet, using a long line threaded through a floor ring for corrections at a distance. After more practice, with just a hint of down, the dogs dropped when tagged. Not every time, but half the time, then two-thirds of the time, until finally he could stand motionless and watch while Essay dashed across the mow, nosed Babu's hindquarters, and Babu sank to the floor. Edgar celebrated by rolling them onto their backs and holding their feet against his face. They were fastidious about their pads, and when he inhaled against them, an earthy popcorn smell filled his senses. The dogs craned their necks to watch, eyeing him as if astounded, and boxing and writhing to coax him back again. He clapped them to their feet for more practice. Always the same few commands now. He played them again in different orders with different pairings, different obstacles, longer or shorter releases. Roll on your back. Carry this to the other dog. Tag that dog. It was very late, and he was almost tired enough to sleep when he chose a sequence at random and watched them work it out. Opal trotted across the mow, holding a dowel in her mouth. She tagged Umbra. Umbra dropped to the floor. Something about the sight of it brought Edgar to his feet. He had them repeat the sequence. Carry this to that dog. Tag that dog. Down when you're tagged. All at once, blood was roaring in his ears. He understood that an idea had slowly been dawning on him, parceled out over the course of days in bits and pieces from some dim compartment of his mind. They went through the drill again. Each time he saw more clearly the image of Claude backing out of the barn, looking for something dropped or flung away, the white snowy world behind him. If that sight brought the memory back for Edgar, might it do the same for Claude? When he was too tired to run the dogs, he sat and peered at the photograph of Claude and Forte. He closed his eyes and lay on his side, distantly aware that the dogs had gathered around, watching. For so long he'd lurched between one truth and another. Nothing had seemed certain. Nothing had even seemed knowable. But now, perhaps, he'd found a way to know for sure. Driving lesson. He heard the sound of footsteps on the mow stairs, and his mother ducked around the vestibule door, her dark hair in a loose ponytail that swung sinuously across her shoulders. Essay, Tinder, and Opal were in the mow with Edgar, in sit-stays at the moment, and he was holding a length of thick rope knotted at both ends of the kind they used for practicing retrieves. Almondine lay sprawled near the doorway. "How about a ride into town?" his mother said. "We could stop for lunch." The three yearlings, excited by his mother's appearance, began to lift their haunches off the floor, and Edgar stepped into their line of sight and caught their gazes until they settled back into sits. When he was sure they would stick, he turned to his mother.
"I want to keep working, Essay," he signed, a half-truth.
He'd begun the morning practicing the tag-and-down sequence, but they'd fought him on it, playing dumb after being pushed night after night. He wanted more than anything to be left alone to work, for there to be no chance that the sight of Claude near his mother would bring on one of those cramps of anger that could snatch his breath away. The idea of the three of them squeezed into the truck, or worse, the Impala, set off a caw of panic in his mind. His mood, after a night of half-recalled dreams in which he repeatedly slipped from the branches of the apple tree into some formless abyss, was already black and raw.
"Okay," she said cheerily. "Someday you'll be my son again. I just know it."
He heard their voices in the yard, and then the truck started and crunched along the driveway, and Edgar and the dogs went back to work. He clapped up Almandine, and they went through a few retrieves while the yearlings watched. When Essay had executed three fetches in a row without a mistake, Edgar rotated Opal through the routine, then Tinder. And then he began with Essay again, this time, lest she grow bored, tossing the rope into a maze of straw bales he had hastily constructed. When Tinder finished, he led them all downstairs. He decided to eat an early lunch, rather than risk their coming back while he was in the house. He walked past the Impala, checking the impulse to mule-kick a dent into its side, and let Almandine up the porch steps ahead of him. When he walked into the kitchen, Claude was sitting at the table. He was smoking a cigarette, and the newspaper was quartered in his hand. Edgar's first impulse was to turn and stalk out, while the spring on the porch door was still jangling. But he forced himself to cross the kitchen and yank open the refrigerator and pile sandwich fixings on the table. Claude kept reading as Edgar slapped together slices of bread and cheese and pimento loaf. At last, Claude laid aside the newspaper.
"I'm glad you came in," he said. "There's something I want to talk to you about."
Edgar faced the cool depths of the refrigerator and pretended to hunt for something. Then he pulled out a chair across from Claude and sat and began to eat his sandwich.
"You know how to drive that truck?"
Claude asked. Edgar shook his head, which was the truth. His father had let him steer now and then from the passenger side, but only briefly.
"Now that's a crime," Claude said. "When Gar and I were your age, we'd already been driving for quite a while. It's handy sometimes, you know."
Edgar tore off a corner of his sandwich and handed it down to Almandine.
"I've been trying to talk your mom into the idea we ought to teach you, but she's not convinced. She's in favor of driver's ed."
He said driver's ed as if it were the silliest thing in the world.
"One day our dad just took us out and showed us how, that's all. After about an afternoon of tooling around, we were all set. Down to popcorn corners and back to begin with. A milk run, like they say."
Edgar thought he understood where Claude was heading, and he nodded.
"Of course, you and I have an advantage. It was all stick back then, every truck we ever had. But the Impala's automatic. As long as your mom's off in town, I was thinking you and I might have a little fun. Something we could slip off and do. Something your mom doesn't necessarily even need to know about. By the time you get into driver's ed, you'll be the best in your class. Plus, you'll impress the hell out of your mom the first time you two go for a practice drive. What do you say?"
Edgar looked at Claude. "Oh," he fingerspelled as he took a bite of his sandwich. "K," he signed. Claude watched Edgar's hands, then slapped the table.
"There you go," he said. "Swallow it down, son. It's time to take the wheel. Your whole life's about to change."
He rattled the newspaper together and stood and twirled the car keys around his finger. Edgar set the remains of his sandwich on the table and stood and walked out with Almandine at his heels. The Impala was parked facing the road, driver's side wheels resting in the grass. Claude opened the passenger door and prepared to get in, but when he saw Almandine, he tipped the seat forward and said, "Jump in, honey. Your boy's about to amaze you." Then Claude said one thing more. He was looking down the drive with his forearm resting on the roof of the car. He patted the metal with the flat of his hand. "Right here's something Gar never would have done," he said. "He'd have kept you pinned down as long as he could." Almandine had jumped into the back seat. Now she was looking out at Edgar, panting. He'd been hearing a ringing in his ears ever since Claude had said the word son. And now something that had been hanging by a thread inside him seemed to come loose. He opened the driver's side door. "Come out," he signed to Almandine. "You have to stay home." She looked at him and panted. "Come," he signed. He stepped back. Almandine maneuvered out of the car again, and he led her up the porch steps and into the kitchen. He squatted down in front of her and ran his hand over her head and down her ruff, and he took a long look at the sublime pattern of gold and brown in her irises. "You're a good girl," he signed. "You know that." Then he closed the door and walked back to the Impala. Claude stood watching him over the flat blue expanse of its roof. The three little vents set into the car's flanks reminded Edgar of shark's gills. "Let's go." He didn't care if Claude understood his sign. His body language was clear enough. Claude dropped into the bucket seat on the passenger side. He rolled down his window, and Edgar did the same. "You know the gas from the brake, right? Everybody knows that." Claude handed Edgar his ring of keys. Edgar examined them up in the light and gave the gas pedal an experimental push. "You don't want to pump the gas," Claude said. "You'll flood it." The key slid smoothly into the ignition, and the Impala's starter whirred, and the engine roared to life. Edgar held the key twisted over a moment too long, and there was a horrendous grinding noise. He let up, then, seeing the expression on Claude's face, twisted it again. He pulled his foot off the gas pedal and set it on the floor and listened to the motor idle. Claude started talking again, but Edgar wasn't paying attention. He tested the brake pedal experimentally, felt it give under his foot. The shifter was on the column. The orange tip of the gear indicator was under the speedometer. He'd seen people do this before with automatic transmissions. He pulled the shift lever back and dropped it into D. The car began to roll forward. "That's right," Claude said. "Nice and easy." The steering wheel turned with a strange, oily smoothness compared to Alice. Edgar wondered if the Impala had power steering. Stranger yet was the huge flat hood extending in front of them. He was used to a thin, orange oblong with a smokestack coughing black fumes. This felt like steering from behind a vast blue table. The engine sounded distant and muffled, and he couldn't see what the front wheels were doing. He had to steer by feel alone. "That's good," Claude said. "Just ease it down the drive and we'll see what's coming. Take a left, head down toward the corner so your mom won't catch us as she's coming back from town." Edgar looked at him and nodded. He began to press the gas pedal, and then, without quite realizing he'd made any decision, his foot kept pressing down, a surprisingly long way, until it was flat against the floor. The Impala bellowed. It fishtailed in place on the dirt and gravel of the driveway. Edgar had a good grip on the wheel, and he kept the car more or less straight ahead as it shot forward. Maybe a little on the grass to the right, but that was better than clipping the house. "Whoa there, son," Claude exclaimed. "You got a tiger by the tail. Let up. Whoa!" It took no time at all to reach the end of the driveway. Edgar wondered how fast they were going, but he didn't have time to look at the speedometer. So much was happening. For one thing, the trees in the orchard were coming up fast on the right. For another, he had craned around to watch the barn receding in the back window. And that was difficult to do with his foot squashed down on the gas. When he faced front again, he thought a very long time before he decided not to run the car straight off the road into the woods across the driveway, because he knew they weren't really going that fast. Out on the road, they'd be able to pick up a lot more speed. As the last apple tree blurred past the side window, he started turning the wheel. Claude had stopped shouting, "Whoa!" as if they were on a horse-drawn wagon, and reached over to throw the wheel to the left. They struggled a little, trying to agree on when to return the wheel to center. Edgar thought it should happen when the mailbox was dead square in front of the windshield. But Claude wanted to start earlier than that. Together they worked out a compromise. The Impala's nose heaved left, and the car performed a deeply satisfying slide. And then they were crossways in the road, or nearly, and there was the deafening sound of gravel being chewed up under the tires and spat at the quarter panels. Claude now had both his hands on the wheel. He had definite ideas about the direction they should be headed. "Okay," Edgar signed. "You steer." He took his hands away, keeping his foot smashed down on the gas pedal. Unburdened of the task of navigating, he could twist around to look through the rear window again. It was exhilarating to see the road shrinking away like a broad brown strip of taffy being pulled out of the trunk. Also, now he had time to check the speedometer. He didn't know if it was right. It didn't seem like they could be climbing past 50 already. They weren't even to the fence line. Maybe it was just the wheels spinning out on the gravel. On the other hand, they had started moving pretty fast once Claude got them headed down the center of the road. Claude had once said the car was a 420-something. Edgar thought that was good. He thought that meant it would go very, very fast. Air began to roar through the open windows. "Don't we get to listen to some music?" he signed. Then Claude was shouting about the gas pedal. Edgar reached past him and turned on the radio. Over the roar of the engine, he heard the steely twang of a guitar. "Country music," he signed. "My favorite." He pressed one of the big black preset buttons to switch channels, then another. "I really don't like it when you call me son," he signed. "That's not right. I'm not your son." He turned the radio off again. "I can't understand you," Claude said. "Let up on the gas, for Christ's sake." "In fact," he signed, "I really don't like you being in my house at all." Claude reached over and tried to shift the transmission into neutral. But Edgar put his hands on the steering wheel again and wrenched it to the left. The car slewed across the gravel, and a stand of maple trees filled the windshield. Claude let go of the shifter and put both hands back on the wheel and, to Edgar's surprise, was able to square their line of travel with the road again. Now the speedometer was up to 73. The Impala was jittering around as if it were traveling on a strip of ball bearings. That was the fastest he had ever traveled in a car, Edgar thought, and it was interesting that it was on gravel. The speed really ate up the road. Ahead, he could see where the dirt merged onto the broad curve of blacktop that continued north and veered east to Popcorn Corners. There was a little bridge over a creek up ahead, and he wondered if they could get the Impala up to 75 by the time they reached it. Before he had a chance to ponder it further, they'd arrived. There was a lurch, and when they landed again, Edgar felt as if his body were still sailing through the air while his eyes had fallen back to earth. He smiled at Claude and checked the speedometer. They'd made it to 75, after all. The hood of the Impala was tarnished, and that was a shame. On a nice day, he bet it would be fine to see the clouds climbing across that blue mirror stretched out in front of them. like flying into the sky.
Okay, Claude said. He had quickly gotten the knack of steering from the passenger side. They hardly wobbled at all, which was a good thing, because the road was narrow.
Okay, Claude repeated. You're the boss. What do you want?
Edgar wondered that himself. He didn't really have a plan. In fact, the whole driving thing had been Claude's idea. And there was that clanging in his head. It was driving him batty. He tried hammering the heel of his palm against his forehead to make it stop. It didn't help, though at least now his head had a reason to ring. He turned and grinned sheepishly at Claude.
Why not go all the way to Popcorn Corners? He sighed. A milk run, like they say.
I don't understand you, Claude said. You know I can't read
P-O-P-C-O.
Don't fucking fingerspell at me, Claude shouted. Let up on the gas.
And then before Edgar could react, Claude reached past him and flipped the transmission lever up into neutral. From where he sat, Claude couldn't have seen the shifter window in the dashboard, so it had to have been a wild guess, and he might easily have thrown it into reverse instead. That was an interesting possibility, and one Edgar hadn't considered before. What happened if you dropped into reverse going, what, 64 miles an hour? No, make that 58. 50. The sound of the Impala's engine, roaring while in gear, now rose to a shriek, as if it might leap from its moorings. Claude twisted the key, and the engine died. They drifted to a stop. For a while, there was just the sound of the two of them panting, and a clicking, thumping sound. Edgar looked down and discovered his foot spastically pumping the gas pedal. Their plume of dust caught up with them, then swept past, a dry brown fog. The cooling engine block made a low ticking sound.
When do I learn to parallel park? Edgar sighed. I hear that's tricky.
Claude pulled the keys out of the ignition and sat back in the passenger seat. He couldn't possibly have understood what Edgar had signed, but he started to laugh anyway. Pretty soon he was howling and slapping his knee. Edgar got out of the car and began to walk back up the road toward the house, 2 or 3 miles distant. Behind him, he heard the passenger door slam and the crunch of footsteps on gravel. The starter of the Impala whined and stopped. Before Edgar had gotten far up the road, Claude had backed the car around, and then it was rolling along beside Edgar. The engine made a wounded sound, and something was tapping or clicking under the hood. Whatting, 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 ting, 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 ting.
I guess I had it wrong about driving, Claude said. No hard feelings?
Edgar walked along.
While you're enjoying your stroll, you might want to consider that you and I have people in common. Your mother, for instance.
And my father, he sighed.
Claude couldn't help trying to read his sign, even when Edgar flashed it out. The Impala rolled alongside him while Claude replayed the gestures in his mind.
Yeah, likewise, Claude said, taking a wild guess.
Then he gave the Impala the gas. It knocked and stuttered down the road. He'd gone about a half mile toward the house before the car slid to a stop again, and he climbed out.
You're just like your father, God damn it all, he shouted, kicking the gravel.
Then he turned and climbed into the Impala and roared away. Trudy. If Trudy hadn't been preoccupied as she drove to Mellon, she might have felt pleasure in the trip, for it was one of those perfectly warm June days when the sun felt like a voluptuous and reassuring hand pressing down on a person's skin. Ordinarily, she liked the radio, but the roar of air past the truck window was best for thinking, and Edgar was on her mind. He was engaged in a rebellion she didn't completely understand. It was over Claude, she knew that much. 3 nights in the last week, he'd refused to come in from the kennel, sleeping instead in the mow. But whenever she tried to talk to him, he just walked off, or stood there and shut her out as only Edgar could. He had, of course, always been hard to read, even as a little boy, so inward and stoic, beyond anything she'd expected. He had virtually never cried as an infant. Almandine had done his demanding for him, half nursemaid, half courier. His teachers attributed his stoicism to his lost voice, but Trudy knew that wasn't it. In fact, Edgar had started communicating with a desperate urgency when he was only a year old. By the time he was 2, he had absorbed the clumsily demonstrated basics of sign language and begun, to her amazement, to construct a vocabulary of his own. There'd been a period, memorable but exhausting, when he demanded she name things, from the moment he woke until his eyes fluttered closed in exhausted sleep. The ferocity with which he applied himself was almost frightening, and though she supposed it could have been a perverse form of motherly pride, she couldn't believe such obsession was typical. Almost in self-defense, they'd handed him the dictionary and started him naming the pups. He had also been demonstrative and intelligent from the very beginning, his questions startlingly insightful. She would watch him absorb a new idea and wonder what effect it would have on him, because with Edgar, everything came out eventually, somehow. But the process, how he put together a story about the world's workings, that was mysterious beyond all ken. In a way, she thought, it was the only disappointing thing about having a child. She'd imagined he would stay transparent to her, more part of her, for so much longer. But despite the proximity of the daily work, Edgar had ceased long before to be an open book. A friend, yes. A son she loved, yes. But when it came to knowing his thoughts, Edgar could be as opaque as a rock. A perfect example had been the Christmas when he was 5. He'd started kindergarten that year. Every morning, they stood together at the end of the driveway, and she'd watched him board the school bus. And every noon he'd returned, hands upraised to greet Almandine, who almost flattened the boy as soon as he stepped clear of the bus, making such a spectacle that other children called Almandine's name from the bus window. Edgar had been excited to be around other children that fall, but he wouldn't tell her much about school unless she probed him. What had they done that day? Was his teacher nice? Did she read stories? Then she would coax him into telling her the story. Sometimes there was a sign he didn't have yet, and together they would look it up in the sign dictionary, and if that failed, invent one on the spot. When December came, he'd sat at the kitchen table and written out a wish list for Santa, and sealed it in an envelope before she could read it. She had to wait until he was asleep to steam the envelope open. At the top of his list, he'd written, "Pocket watch, with a chain." It had taken her completely by surprise. He had never once expressed a desire for a watch, and he already knew how to tell time. He'd learned when he was 4. For a few long weeks, he had included the time in everything he said. "At 6:15, we are going to eat dinner. When I get done with my bath, it will be 8:30. That had quickly lost its thrill, but perhaps his obsession with telling time had just been internalized, gone opaque. In any case, it was the number one thing on his list, and she was determined he would find it under the tree. She and Gar located a watch shop in Ashland, whose proprietor rummaged around in back and produced an old pocket watch that a boy might use, and almost certainly break. And it came with a long chain. The winding knob was intricately knurled, and engraved on the brass cover was a flowery letter C. Trudy liked the C. They could say it stood for Christmas. The man told them it would run for almost a whole day when fully wound. Perhaps it lost 5 or 10 minutes, but that would be okay for a boy. Better, in fact, since he would have to wind and set it frequently. They'd wrapped the watch and put it under the tree, and made sure that the smallish box in green foil was the last one Edgar opened. He looked at the watch in his hand and smiled exactly the smile she'd been hoping for, and then he slipped it neatly into the pocket of his pajamas.
"Aren't you even going to open it?" Trudy cried. "Press the little lever. Look at the hands."
He took it out of his pocket and let them demonstrate how to wind the works and set the time. He watched intently, but when they'd finished, he closed it up and slipped it back into his pocket. That was the last they saw of it for almost a week, until Trudy walked into the living room and found Almandine in a sit and Edgar swinging the watch back and forth before her eyes. Almandine panted and looked past the swinging timepiece at Edgar. When Edgar understood that someone else was in the room, he turned around.
"It doesn't work on dogs," he signed.
"You were trying to hypnotize her?" Trudy had said.
"That's why you wanted a watch?"
He nodded.
"Come on," he signed to Almandine. "It'll work better on puppies."
And he pulled on his coat and marched out to the kennel, while Trudy stood there, mouth hanging open. That had been the moment she'd realized how he carried things around inside, things entirely separate from her. 5 years old, barely in kindergarten. She had no idea where he'd heard of hypnosis. She couldn't remember seeing anything on TV that might have put it in his head. She didn't think any of his books mentioned it. Wherever he had picked it up, he'd been walking around with that idea for weeks, months maybe, without mentioning it even once. Just watching, thinking, wondering. That was the kind of boy he was. And she realized that he was, in some sense, already lost to her, had outgrown her in some essential way. He wasn't keeping secrets. If she had known to ask him if he was interested in hypnosis, he would have told her. He just hadn't offered the information because she hadn't asked. And the obvious question was, what else was he thinking about? What else had he already learned that no one even suspected? Edgar's career as a hypnotist continued for several weeks. At the high point, he mesmerized little Alex Franklin into throwing a snowball into the playground teacher's ear. When Trudy investigated further, it turned out that Alex Franklin had made that claim. Edgar had only told the boy, deeply under the influence of his swinging timepiece, to take a bite of a snowball that looked more than a tad yellow. Instead, Alex had extended his arms like Frankenstein's monster and trundled toward the teacher, then wound up and let fly. Edgar hadn't expected that. The whole hypnosis business was unpredictable, he'd confessed. Which led to a discussion about responsibility. It was like with the dogs, Trudy had told him. If you asked them to do something, you were responsible for what happened next, even if that wasn't what you intended. You were especially responsible to the dogs, she said, because they respected you enough to do what you'd asked, even if it seemed like nonsense to them. If you wanted them to trust you, you had better take responsibility, every single time. And then she'd let him try to hypnotize her. But she didn't get sleepy, sleepy. He'd been disappointed, but she wouldn't lie to him about it. Nor would Gar, nor would Almandine, nor any of the puppies, who wanted to swat the watch out of his hands and chew it to bits. Then Edgar gave up on the whole idea, though he didn't stop carrying the watch around. Once in a while he opened the cover and checked it against the kitchen clock and wound it. But Trudy suspected he did this only when he was around them. By the time the snow had melted that spring, she found the watch lying buried among his touchingly small, white, fruit-of-the-loom underwear in his bottom dresser drawer. If Edgar had been inward and opaque to her at 5, now he was a total mystery. Since Gar's death, he'd been sleepwalking through his days, looking angry one minute, then tragic, then thoughtful and happy a moment later. Only working his litter seemed to capture his attention. She told herself she shouldn't worry. After all, he could have been shooting drugs. If a person could even find drugs in Melon, which she doubted. If he really wanted to spend day and night in the kennel, let him. Truthfully, this latest obsession hadn't started until long after Guard died. Really, the last couple of weeks of school, when he'd taken to running off from his classes. She'd talked with the principal. She wasn't going to have them cracking down on Edgar and ruining his attitude toward school for good when he was muddling through what, she was sure, would turn out to have been the worst period of his life. He was delicate right now. Deal with this rebellion wrong, and it would set. She didn't think that the lessons from dog training always transferred to people. But it was just the nature of things that if you punished anyone, dog or boy, when they got close to a thing, they'd get it in their head the thing was bad. She'd seen people ruin dogs too many times by forcing them to repeat a trial that scared the dog or even hurt it. Not finding a variation on the same task, not coming at things from a different angle, not making the dog relish whatever it was that had to be done, was a failure of the imagination. And in this case, the analogy applied. She'd told the principal she didn't give a damn whether Edgar showed up even one more day that semester after what he'd been through. And if they pushed him any harder, she would withdraw him herself. They knew as well as Trudy that the teachers were coasting the last couple of weeks. Who cared if he sat in class and stared out the window, or if he just wasn't there? How many farm kids, she asked, went truant when it was time to show livestock at the county fair? She could use the help around the kennel anyway. Then there was Claude, whom Edgar objected to. In his position, who wouldn't? After Gar's death, she and Edgar had grown so close, it was almost as if they'd been a couple themselves. Making dinner, curling up together on the couch to watch television, arms wrapped around each other. She'd fallen asleep that way more than once. And on other nights, when he'd been the one to sleep, she'd stroked his brow like he was a baby. After that, of course he'd be jealous. Maybe she should have held back from him a little, let him handle his grief his own way. But when you're hurting, and your son is hurting, you do what you need to do. Besides, Claude wasn't something she'd planned. About the last thing she'd had in mind, particularly after the nasty falling out between him and Gar. Not that she understood that, a brother thing, buried under too many layers of family history for her to unearth. Things with Claude had just, well, happened one morning. A breakdown on her part, a strange, momentary kindness on his. It hadn't felt wrong. Afterward, she'd even felt as though some great burden had been lifted, as though she'd been given permission to carry on with a different life. What Edgar didn't understand was that it was all going to be a compromise from then on out. That wasn't something she could say, not to Edgar, not to anyone, but she knew it was true. They'd had the real thing, the golden world, the paradise, the kingdom on earth. And you didn't get that twice. When a second chance came, you took it for what it was worth. Yes, Claude had proposed. That was silly, foolishness, not worth discussing. Not then, anyway. Not when there was so much work to be done. She and Gar had had the predictable discussion about what they want the other to do if one of them died. She'd been direct and forthright about his responsibilities. "I want you to spend the rest of your life in abject mourning," she'd said. "Cry in public twice a week. A shrine in the orchard would be nice, but I realize you're going to be busy handling the kennel and giving lectures on my divinity, so I won't insist on that." Gar had been more modest. He'd wanted her to remarry the moment she met someone who made her happy, no sooner and no later. That was Gar in a nutshell, of course. When you asked him a serious question, you got a serious answer every single time. She'd loved him for that, among many other things. He was passionate in a way that Claude would never be, passionate about principles and passionate about order, which he'd seen as a primary good, like those file cabinets filled with records. The kennel had been important when he talked about what should happen if he were to die. He hadn't said it straight out, but he'd clearly expected Trudy would find a way to carry on the work with the dogs. So Trudy thought Gar wouldn't necessarily object to how things were working out. It looked like the kennel would be back in order by the end of the summer. And what they had both cared most about was that the other person find a way to be happy. Gar might not have liked some of the changes Claude was suggesting, but Gar had envisioned remaining a one-kennel boutique breeder forever. Claude was less concerned with bloodlines, which freed him up to think more broadly about other things. In the meantime, it was a matter of seeing into Edgar more clearly, making sure he got through this bad patch. And that's all it was, a bad patch. There wasn't anything seriously wrong. She'd have known at once if there were. Popcorn Corners. The next day, Edgar set out again for Popcorn Corners, this time alone, by bicycle. Anything to get away from the house while Claude was there. And he was there all the time now. Edgar slipped the picture of Claude and Forte into his back pocket and pedaled away to the north, retracing the route he and Claude had traveled along that thin gravel line cut through the Shawamigan Forest. A county gravel truck roared past, drawing a tawny billow in its wake. The air was still thick with dust when he came to the blacktop and turned onto a small forest road. He passed marshes boiling with frogs and snakes, and later a turtle, plodding between the ditches like a living hubcap, its beaked mouth open and panting. A stop sign appeared in the distance. When he reached it, he surveyed the entirety of Popcorn Corners, a tavern, a grocery, three equally decrepit houses, a band of feral chickens that lived in the culverts. He coasted past the tavern, which sported a Ham's Beer sign, lit to show the beer bear fishing in a shimmering land of sky-blue waters, and halted in front of the grocery, covered with white clapboards that hung slightly off-parallel, as if covering some profound skew of the building's timbers. A pair of colossal ash trees cast their shadows across the storefront, and a single antiquated gas pump tilted among the weeds off to the side. The small parking lot was empty. He lowered his bicycle to the ground and pulled the screen door through its quarter circle in the dirt. Up front, behind a long grooved wooden counter, sat Ida Payne, the hawk-nosed, far-sighted proprietor of the store. Stacks of cigarette cartons filled the shelves behind her. Red and white Lucky Strikes, aqua Newports, desert-colored Camels. From somewhere, a radio droned out the news from the AM station in Ashland. Edgar raised a hand in greeting.